My name is Carla Thorson, and I'll be the moderator this evening for our program. And I'm delighted to introduce our distinguished guest this evening. Mark Entwistle served as Canadian ambassador to Cuba from 1993 to 1997. He's one of the world's leading experts on Cuba and continues to work on business development and many other projects in the country. Ambassador Entwistle served as a Canadian diplomat for 16 years in both the foreign and civil service. He is currently a founding partner at Acasta Capital and director of the Belinda Stronach Foundation, Millennium Promise Canada, and the Institute for World Affairs in Washington, D.C. He also serves as vice chair of the board of directors of Psychology Beyond Borders. And he received the Saul Hayes Award for Human Rights of the Canadian Jewish Congress for his work in supporting the Cuban Jewish community. So please join me in welcoming Mark Entwistle for a conversation about reopening the U.S.-Cuban relationship and Canada's role in facilitating this historic change.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So Mark, I'm going to betray my spots a little bit, and being a reformed Soviet specialist, mm-hmm. I actually want to ask a question that I think is probably on many people's minds right now, and that is that many people, I think, believed that at the end of the Cold War and when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the U.S.-Cuban relationship would suddenly change. And I think still others believed that, well, what really needs to happen is Fidel Castro will need to pass away, or the Castro regime will come to an end, and that until that time, the relationship would not change. And so here we are. It's almost 25 years later, in 2015. And I think the question on my mind, and I think on many people's minds, is why now?
I think for people who might have wanted to see a change in political system or a regime in Cuba, it's probably been a long history of dashed hopes, because you know the Castro brothers have been through, you know, 10, maybe 11 American presidents now, and they continue on, and the society continues to function and work. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba was in very dire straits. They lost about 3/4 of their gross domestic product overnight. I, in fact, arrived there my first time in the summer of 1993. You could walk down the main boulevards of the city of Havana and not see a car. People were on Chinese bikes. They called it then, Fidel Castro coined a term, the special period, the periodo especial. And the special period, its formal Cuban version, because the Cubans have this particular way of speaking and the kind of language they use, is actually called the special period of war and time of peace, is the actual formulation, but it got kind of truncated to special period. And that was a series of survival mechanisms, really, for Cuba. They teetered on the edge when the Soviet Union collapsed, because they lost this relationship, their trading relationship with the old Soviet trading system, Comecon, and almost lost it. But within about 4 or 5 years, by the end of the 1990s, they had come back from the precipice. They had recovered themselves. These are kind of consummate survivors in their ability to just to manage their system in a way, rob Peter to pay Paul. It's a very poor country, but they have a tremendous kind of capacity to govern themselves. And in that period, when they were teetering on the edge, they undertook a number of economic reforms. They decentralized their economy. They broke away from the Soviet model. That's, in a way, the period where they actually got some of the ingredients to survive. And of course, people who have been waiting for Fidel Castro to pass away, he's still alive. He's very ill and kind of elderly, but and that will happen at some point. But I think people will, still have hopes dashed, if that was indeed their hope, because I believe that in the absence of legitimacy, that comes from, for example, multi-party democratic elections for a government, there's a very, very peculiar and particular Cuban source of a legitimacy, and it's what I've always termed a kind of a social contract between the Cuban people and the Cuban state or the Cuban government. Cuban people are very tired. They're worn out. They're tired of being poor. They're tired of not having economic opportunity. But the social contract roughly goes as follows. The people say to the government of Cuba, you give us as much of a universal healthcare system as you can afford. You give us as much of a universal public education system free as you can afford. You make sure the electricity works. You make sure there's food supply. You make sure the transportation system works. And essentially, we'll provide time. And that's what the Cuban government focuses on, especially in the Raul period. In the Fidel period, you had a little more a reflection of a different personality, a more kind of mercurial, charismatic style of leadership with all kinds of ideas, and Cuba very active on the world stage in some ways kind of in an adventurous way, especially in the 1980s. But that was very typical of the Fidel Castro style. His brother, completely different. His brother's a managerial kind of leader, very pragmatic, very focused on the concrete things, and essentially focused on the core elements of this social contract. So frankly, that's one of the reasons, I think, that when the Soviet Union collapsed and all the changes happened and Fidel Castro left the presidency, he got very sick, as you may recall, transferred power to his brother. You had this kind of ability to continue, and it's partly because the relationship, the political equation in Cuba is so much more nuanced than we might believe to be the case.
I think the question is also on the U.S. side. What has changed? What prompted this historic announcement by President Obama? And because the negotiations were so secret, I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about Canada's role in facilitating these negotiations. And as a diplomat, longstanding diplomat, were you involved in the process?
I'll do the last one first, no. And I don't think, in fact, any longstanding or serving diplomat seem to have been involved in that process. I'll start at the process piece first. It was a very interesting one. Unbelievable that they managed to keep that process secret in three capitals. That lasted over approximately, I believe, about 18 months. Multiple meetings, at least seven of which were held in Canada. They met at the Vatican as well. For anybody who knows politics and political communications, I lived in that world for many years as press secretary of the Canadian Prime Minister. And so, to me, I'm astounded that how this could not have gotten out. It's unbelievable in DC, in Ottawa, and in Havana. Havana more, you could see the secret. But I think what happened was that the presidents purposefully kept the machinery of the usual machinery of government and the foreign policy establishment out of the loop. They weren't involved. At very senior levels were not involved. This was done between personal representatives of the presidents, which is, in a way, the only way you can deliver this kind of transformational decision. This was a highly disruptive act that the presidents undertook. And frankly, I don't think the apparatus of normal everyday government could probably have handled it. So it was done very personally, in the top secret. The government of Canada was not involved in the substance of the talks. Both the United States and Cuba have long let countries like Canada know that there's no need for that kind of interlocutor role. The two countries can talk to each other when they want to talk to each other and do it directly. But they needed a safe and neutral place. They couldn't do it in Washington, couldn't do it in Havana, of course. So they needed to go somewhere where they could have this kind of conversation and ask the government of Canada if we would do that, to which the Prime Minister agreed. And we were really the innkeeper, so to speak, but help give them the ability to have the conversation. One could speculate that the cows come home, because I haven't been in kind of inside the brain, the inner workings of either president about the motivations. But it's fairly clear to me as an outside observer of this process that both presidents showed a level of political will and, frankly, in my opinion, leadership that one doesn't see in the world very often to undertake such a disruptive and transformational act. I never thought I would see this day. I don't think anybody who watched the Cuba piece. I thought they'd be ships passing in the night forever, and you know, in our lifetime, and you know, they would just continue kind of trundling along until that day on December 17th. I can only assume that the President of the United States is looking at legacy issues. This is something that is probably an anomaly in foreign policy. My own opinion is, if it was truly a foreign policy issue in your country, it would have been perhaps settled a long time ago. It's so profoundly a domestic political issue related to presidential electoral politics. I think a number of things have happened. The demographic shift, the sea change of opinion in the Cuban American community in Miami on these issues created a different kind of environment. Miami's changed a lot on Cuba. The travel between Cuban Americans and the island now is extensive. And I think most outside of a kind of now a still very active and very vocal and opinionated, but increasingly small group of members of the Cuban American community, I think most Cuban Americans kind of just want to get on with it and be able to see families and have travel and help to participate again. And also, you know, there's a political dimension as well, because you're getting a migration now of younger Cuban Americans to the Democratic Party. So there's a whole bunch of supportive reasons, I think, why the president felt he could take this on. The embargo, as you may know, is a real mashup of all kinds of bits and pieces. It's part law, part presidential order, part regulation. The president can do certain things, he can't do certain other things. One has the opinion that the president of the United States, though, is on a mission on the Cuba file, which makes this experience very different from any other attempt to have some kind of rapprochement because of the engagement of the executive branch. In April 2009, President Obama issued a presidential statement making a number of changes to travel regulations and also urging an opening for telecommunications companies. And it took the bureaucracy through the Office of Foreign Asset Control of the Department of the Treasury, the famed OFAC, years to develop those regulations to give effect to the president's desires. This time, OFAC amended its regulations in weeks. I'd say 3 weeks they were done. This is unheard of. So having the attention of the president to move this along, clearly, I think, is a big difference. And I believe he wants to robustly and aggressively, at least from what I can see, use every aspect of his executive authority to get as much done on this. He will hit Congress at some point around trade and investment aspects of this. But, you know, frankly, you can apply a number of cliches here, in my opinion. You know, the genie's out of the bottle on this one. It's very hard to think how you can stuff it back in. And you have U.S. business now has found their voice in a way that was not the case in the past. Public opinion's clearly there. It's bipartisan in many ways. There are Republicans in both the House and the Senate who are very supportive. So, I'm a net optimist on this, and although, of course, there'll be many bumps on the road. On the Cuban side, one would wonder why on earth the Cubans would do this. And I think there's all kinds of theories, and you will hear some of them out there, that, you know, it's an act of desperation on the part of the Cuban leadership because they're about to lose their oil subsidy, Venezuelan oil subsidy. President Maduro in Venezuela is a little shaky. You know, Hugo Chavez, he is not. And the Cubans, in desperation, will turn to the United States to be their economic saviors. This is not, in my opinion, the rationale of the government of Cuba. There are elements of the Cuban political leadership who would not be very supportive of this, actually. And to his credit, one must give credit where credit is due, I think Raul Castro showed a kind of leadership that we're not accustomed to in terms of looking at Cuban leaders, because he's in a different situation than his brother. His brother did have a capacity to issue edicts and orders, and people would do things, partly because of his force of his personality. By style and personality and just a different place, Raul Castro has to take the time to build consensus around these issues, and clearly did a fair amount of good old-fashioned political work to get this done. My own personal view is that the Cuban leadership has decided as a fundamental decision, and in fact they've been quite explicit about parts of this, that the old model, the what they call in Cuban Spanish the proyecto, the project, which equals the revolution, in many respects the model has failed. Does not work. They have a need to evolve to something else in the kind of controlled, highly risk-averse way that they do. But this kind of act is part of a general evolution of Cuba, slow and glacial as it may seem, to something else. And it's time to have a more normal relationship with the United States.
So the international community is also long opposed the U.S. embargo.
Yes. I mean,
for at least 22 consecutive years, the U.N. General Assembly has passed a resolution condemning the embargo. So do you think that the recent moves by the U.S. Will actually help to change Cuba's status in international circles? I know, for example, that Cuba will send delegates to the Summit of the Americas in April of this year, and that's the first time since 1962 when it was expelled from the organization. But are there other things that we might anticipate that will change Cuba's status internationally as a result of the U.S. shift in at least viewpoint, if not a lifting of the embargo yet?
Absolutely. I think there's at least two aspects to that in terms of international impact. I think there's an impact on Cuba, clearly. There are pieces of the U.S. embargo that have far-reaching impact on Cuba. I've always believed that the principal impact of the U.S. trade and investment embargo has not really been on the trading relationship, because Cuba, for those of you who have been there, I don't know how many of you have been there, but it's a quirky place. It has its own peculiar personality, without question, but it's not an isolated country. Literally, well, you can count on the fingers of one hand the countries that do not maintain a quite normal state-to-state relationship. There's businesses there from dozens of countries. It's a country that's engaged in the world. But what the embargo did through what legal international law folks call its extraterritorial applications, it was a very far-reaching piece of legislation. And when I say embargo, I do mean this kind of clumping together of all these bits and pieces. Essentially, at its core, if you take a piece of legislation like the like the Helms-Burton Act, because of its extraterritorial reach, it reaches deep into the U.S. subsidiaries operating in foreign countries, even though they're under the jurisdiction of foreign countries. So this caused both a capital freeze, credit freeze. Corporate counsels usually wouldn't want to risk exposure to any liability of companies who... foreign companies who also maintain a significant presence in the United States market. So it had a chilling effect, without question. Eventually, any kind of lifting of the trade and investment embargo, in addition to allowing U.S. companies to participate in Cuba, will open the capital markets for greater access for Cuba. That would be a change. There are other aspects of the embargo, such as the... inclusion of Cuba on the state-sponsored terrorism list, that if Cuba's removed from that by legal implication through a whole series of kind of cascading consequences means that United States objection to the international financial institutions playing a role in Cuba, like the World Bank and the IMF and countries like this, where the United States essentially blocked Cuban access to those funds. In its economic development, what I think we is interesting to remember, for all of its difficulties, and it has many, and it's a poor developing country, and and as I mentioned, it's got a different political system and all of this kind of stuff. In some ways, it's a remarkable story. In fact, they've survived the way they've survived. It's almost inexplicable in some ways, because they do not have access to the international financial institutions and the largesse of the World Bank and others, like most of the developing world does. And it's a very grassroots, bootstrap, homegrown, do-it-yourself, you know, it's a DIY-type economy. And but that would change with the lifting of the embargo simply because of the greater access to capital markets. A lifting of the trade and investment embargo in terms of impact on the United States and its international reputation, clearly it would remove an irritant with a number of friends and allies, including my own country, the European Union, who found the extraterritorial elements of parts of the embargo highly irritating. It would improve relationships with banks and other places because, of course, what has often been done, because the embargo, and I don't think people quite realize this, it's so far-reaching because it's against the embargo law, it's against the law to use U.S. currency, which, because that gets captured in the embargo. So you can imagine how much U.S. dollars move around the world. So they freeze transactions through the New York Clearinghouse of dollars. And what happens is, through entering through the Patriot Act and others in the global war on terrorism, they also go in and have a look at Cuban financial transactions, and they shut them all down. They close bank accounts. They do all. It's very, very, extremely far-reaching, and that is a tremendous irritant, of course, to all kinds of companies, foreign governments, et cetera, et cetera. That would be removed. The net reputation value, so to speak, of moving past that episode, I think there's all kinds of implications and repercussions.
Well, those are things that are yet to come, I would think.
Yes, and hope, you know, I say hopefully because I will betray a prejudice. I do hope that it happens. I do. I think it's good for the American people. I think it's good for the Cuban people. They need to know each other. I personally believe that the old chestnut of supporting the government, and this will only support the Castros, is a red herring argument. The country's an evolution as it is, and the Cuban people will only benefit from an ability to know the American people. So I really do hope it happens.
Well, so let's come back to for a moment, because I think there is a great deal of hope and anticipation about what will happen. And I'd like to actually ask what actually has been agreed to so far, because this is really an early stage of a big change, but a lot of the things you're talking about haven't happened yet.
No.
So maybe you can just take a moment and talk about what are the things that actually have happened as a result of this agreement in December.
Exactly. In the big picture of all of the issues, what has happened is relatively modest. Mm-hmm. Historic, absolutely historic. The change in tonality around the issue is completely changed. Both presidents have overturned 60 years of hostility. The distrust is still there, profoundly, but the notion that that the conversation can't take place, or that the Cuba's a pariah state somehow, has been removed in a few sentences pronounced on December 17th. That's a big change in a concrete way. The principal change or first step, I guess is the best way to put it, is the restoration of diplomatic relations. Both countries, you may or may not know, do not have formal diplomatic relations. They have diplomatic premises, I guess you could say, in both countries. They're formally in a very quirky, piece of international diplomacy, operate offices in each other's countries as an interest section under the auspices of the government of Switzerland. So they're technically offices inside the embassy of Switzerland, but they're both in their old embassy buildings. The United States has a great massive building on the main seashore thoroughfare, relatively recently renovated. I don't know how many American government employees work there. I'd say probably 100. The Cubans are in a very choice location in Washington, D.C., on M Street. They're in their old embassy building. So a lot of the functionality of an embassy exists now. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of contact, actually, more than one would think. It tends to be around practical, pragmatic issues like drug interdiction, environmental issues a little bit, migration issues. Immigration issues is a big piece. So they have a presence there, but there's no formal diplomatic relationship which would enable them to have a kind of normal conversation between each other on the whole bunch of other issues that are a lot more thorny. That's the first step, and the process has begun. A State Department delegation went to Havana in January, led by Roberta Jacobson, Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere. Her counterpart in Cuba runs it. They will get all the mechanics of opening embassies done. There will be ambassadors exchanged, providing the Senate approves the appointment of the U.S. ambassador, which could be interesting. But that will that's in train. In addition, the president reiterated his support for loosening of restrictions around American telecommunications companies to operate in Cuba. Internet, telephone, that kind of thing, which created some buzz in the U.S. telecom business. It, you know, will obviously remain to be seen the degree to which, you know, Cuba wishes to do business with U.S. telecom companies and what the needs are. But that space is now legally open. There has been some restrictions removed on travel issues. The number of Americans who are allowed to travel now has been increased under general license from the Treasury, which means you just self-declare yourself as going under one of several categories. There's 16 categories now, which are now fairly broad and interpretive, whereas before you had to go and seek out a specific license and get it from OFAC and be allowed to travel. There are some restrictions to travel that remain. You can now bring back Cuban cigars if you're in one of those 16 categories. But the categories are broad enough that Cuban economists estimate, right now there's about 90,000 Americans who go to Cuba, some legally under Treasury license, many not so. The occupancy of Cuban hotels is in Havana anyway, is now, even without these openings, overwhelmingly American. Some hotels are 60-70% of their occupancy are U.S. citizens. Cuban economists predict that in the next year, probably 500,000 Americans will go. Where they're all going to stay, I have no idea. But the hotels are booked solid in Havana till April. There's not a hotel room left. And this is mostly American travel already. That's not even talking about the Cuban Americans who have been going for the last 3 years. The U.S. The Association of Travel Agents predicts that after the lifting, if there is to be a lifting of the general travel ban on every American, they predict about 4 million Americans will travel to Cuba in the first year alone, simply because of largely the curiosity factor. So the president has opened up the first portal in travel and quite significantly increased the ability of Americans to travel. He has allowed the use of U.S. origin credit cards. Now, you can't use them a lot in Cuba because there's not so many places to use them. No, big hotels you can. There's been credit cards in Cuba for a long time. They tend to be, they're not U.S. origin cards, but Canadians, Mexicans, and they cleared the transactions through Mexico City largely. Visa's been there for years, MasterCard, that kind of thing. American Express, no. But the credit cards are coming back. But usefully, they'll be able to be used to book travel to Cuba in the United States, which helps travel. It's to encourage and provide support, insurance now, travel insurance. You can get travel insurance when you go to Cuba. These are all part and parcel of normal, everyday things for a U.S. citizen to go somewhere. And while still restricted, the restrictions are markedly more liberal than they were before December 17th. Those are just some of them. There's more. But the big pieces of the embargo piece, which is around trade and investment, mm-hmm. restrictions are still all there. The architecture of the embargo remains in place.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You answered a couple of questions that I've got here. I'm trying to sort as he's talking.
And only $100 worth of cigars.
Only $100 worth of cigars.
Yes.
And how much Havana Club? Don't answer that.
I don't know.
Don't answer that. Okay, so I'd like to spend a few more minutes now on the stumbling blocks.
Yes.
And you mentioned one of them, but I just want to revisit it, and that is the Cuban designation by the U.S. State Department as a state sponsor of terrorism.
Yes.
Or of terror, excuse me.
Yes.
And that's been in place since 1982. So President Reagan, it happened under President Reagan, and the origin of it was the belief that Fidel Castro was training rebels in Central America. But today that designation remains in place, even though the State Department does not believe, as far as we know, that Cuba is supporting terrorist groups. So why do you think that is not something that can easily be lifted? The Cubans obviously want it lifted.
Yes, this is a particularly sore issue for the Cubans. As I understand, the review, the status of Cuba on that list is under review by the Obama administration. I must admit, I'm still somewhat confused about the actual procedures for removing a country from it, because I receive all kinds of different versions of what's involved in it. But I believe that when and if the recommendation goes to the president, that he can and will move on that is my gut feeling. The if there ever was a time in the past when it might have been justified, there it seems to be no evidence why Cuba should be there. And in fact, you're absolutely right. I think the kind of even a formal position of the State Department is that it's anachronistic. The Cubans find it, frankly, offensive in the sense that they believe it to be purely political, related to the domestic management of politics in the United States, and not evidence-based. The salt is rubbed in the wound, the Cuban wound, around this particular issue, because they have a long-standing grievance that when it comes to terrorism-related issues, in 1976, a Cuban civil airliner, Cubana flight, was bombed in midair, killed 73 people on board, clearly an act of terrorism. And they believe they know and have identified the said perpetrator or ringleader of this plot. And have informed the U.S. government over years and amassed evidence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the individual, you know, walks freely, you know, in the United States to the full knowledge of the Department of the Justice, et cetera. So this issue is a very kind of emotional one to Cubans. This is a big issue for them. And I think for the Cuban side of the equation, it's more the symbolism that goes to the core in a way of the conversation about having a more normal relationship. And I don't use, by the way, the verb to normalize. I think I mentioned that sometimes in the past because it implies that there was a normal relationship. I'm a bit of a student of U.S.-Cuban relations. I don't think there's ever really been a normal relationship between the two countries. What we're really talking about here is establishing a new kind of relationship and one that's more normal. In the Cuban mindset, they would think that how can you have a more normal relationship if you have such an abnormal thing as being on the state terrorism list? How can you have a relationship if you think the people are state terrorists? So. And on the U.S. side, removal of Cuba would remove a legal impediment to a whole series of other loosening of the trade and investment embargo and and the involvement of international financial institutions.
So on the same note of things that are anachronistic about the relationship,
yes.
The other sore point on the Cuban side is the base at Guantanamo.
And yes.
we don't talk about it very much here in this country, but can you talk about why the U.S. is still able to maintain this extraterritorial claim in Cuba, and what's the likelihood under this new set of circumstances that the possibility will arise that Cuba would assume control of that territory?
My own personal view is, in the range of issues that are before the two countries, you have short-term ones and you have longer-term ones. This is a thorny one. This is a hard nut, Guantanamo Bay. I'm hoping that the two countries will, for those who for people who wish to see a more normal relationship, which includes myself. My hope is that they'll focus on establishing diplomatic relations, get a proper relationship established and ongoing, so that a dialogue can start on some of these difficult issues in a healthier kind of way than it is now, rather than through kind of recriminations in the UN General Assembly and speeches and, you know, media interviews. They can actually sit around a table and talk about these issues. The U.S. Military base at Guantanamo Bay is a very difficult one. I think it's a substantively different one than a lot of the other issues. It involves different constituencies in your country, different communities, different voices. It involves the defense establishment. It involves national security issues. It's a historic anachronism and anomaly in the sense of it exists in Cuba. It dates back, for those who may not know the history of it, it dates back to the aftermath of the Spanish-American War in the turn of the 20th century. It derives from a piece of U.S. Legislation called the Platt Amendment. I don't know if there's any Cubans or Cuban-Americans in the room or people of Cuban origin, but every school child in Cuba will know about the Platt Amendment. Most Americans and Canadians will not know what the Platt Amendment is. The Platt Amendment was essentially a list of about seven, or there was roughly seven or eight conditions and stipulations that where the government of the United States wished to leave Cuba after its military occupation of Cuba after easily defeating the Spaniards. It was actually run similar to Iraq was run after the Iraq War, where the military ran the country and were really the civil administration. The U.S. military ran Cuba for about 4 years. It was very expensive at the end of the 4 years. So, you know, in Washington, you know, and the bills were coming in, they had to get out of Cuba. But they didn't want to get out of Cuba without maintaining considerable control over the independence of the new country, because they didn't want it kind of drifting off doing crazy things, because it was only 90 miles. So in the Platt Amendment, you have a whole bunch of stipulations, and one of which is the ability of the United States to intervene militarily in Cuban affairs, to protect the interests of the United States, to have essentially a veto over Cuban foreign policy, and to have seven military bases in Cuba. The only one that's left is Guantanamo Bay, so it dates back to that period. The reason, and of course from a Cuban perspective, the reason why it's an issue is that to have a military base of one country on the sovereign territory of another country without the even reasonable permission of the other country is kind of not how it's done. The United States has military bases all over the world, but they're under treaty. And now one could argue, of course, that there was originally a treaty back in 1901. It's just a very, very curious situation. Eventually, it will have to be dealt with. It's just the kind of anomaly that really can't, I don't think, continue indefinitely into the future. I don't know how it will be settled. There are many anecdotes, of course. The United States pays rent for Guantanamo Bay. They send a check every year. U.S. government sends a check to the Cuban government. It arrives, I believe, on the 1st of January, so it's not to be late. And it's for $4,000, and because that was the rent at the time. And this goes on to this day, the government of Cuba refusing to accept the check because it doesn't recognize the legitimacy of a foreign military base on its own sovereign territory, et cetera, sends the check back to the United States, and this goes on year after year in one of those bizarre, surrealistic, idiosyncratic pieces of the U.S.-Cuba relationship. It's an issue that the Cubans will continue to put on the agenda. It's something that kind of can't be overlooked, but I think it's a tough one that will take some time to obviously work through, and there's a heavy political lift on Guantanamo Bay in the U.S., in my opinion.
So now on the U.S. side, to address one of the other big stumbling blocks, for many Americans, the issue of compensation
yes.
for lost property that was expropriated during the Cuban Revolution would appear to be a big issue surrounding normalizing relations. So has that been part of the discussion so far? Is it likely that this will be something that we will hear more about in the early stages of these negotiations?
This is a big issue. It has to be one of the issues eventually over time. I personally, not being party to the current set of talks, to the more limited set of talks to reestablish diplomatic relations, as I understand them, I don't know if they've gotten to this yet. This is clearly a prerequisite issue for eventual lifting, I think, of the full trade and investment embargo. If I'm not mistaken, laws like Helms-Burton have political prerequisite language built into them at the front end, that a set of conditions have to be met before it can be abrogated. Unless I'm mistaken, I believe that some kind of settlement of these of the U.S. certified claims is one of them. It's a very, very kind of quicksand issue, but in a nutshell, there are two types of claims. There are what are called the U.S. certified claims. There are another species of claim, which one could generally call the Cuban American claims. The U.S. certified claims are those of expropriated property of U.S. Nationals at the time of expropriation, companies, individuals. There are 5,911, or they just added 112, not just a few years ago, almost 6,000 of these. They arose from a quasi-judicial, but actually quite disciplined process of adjudication run by the Department of Justice in the early 1960s. These were properties that were expropriated by the revolutionary government in a series of expropriations, cascading expropriations in the early 1960s. The Department of Justice assigned value to them based on, the claim holders had to go and present their deeds and maps and tax rolls, and they had to prove that they had a claim to compensation and what the properties actually were and their value. And it was done quite seriously. There were about, from what I understand, about 10,000 companies and individuals who submitted claims, of which a good 4,000 were ruled inadequate. So a whole bunch of them were not accepted. But there are about 6,000 of these. They range in value, I think about 83% or so of the value of these claims in the designated value from the Department of Justice, plus accrued interest, by the way. There's a 6% simple interest that's added on. And so the clock ticks and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But the value of all of those claims taken together, about 83% of that value is held by roughly less than 20 claimants. So the big claimants are the ones, the big corporations, they control the majority of those claims. The Coca-Colas of the world and AT&T and that kind of thing. The rest are range from little mom and pop operations to other, kind of mid-sized companies. Many of these claim holders long since wrote off the value of their claims as tax deductions, as losses, decades ago. Others, some of them don't even know they have these claims, frankly, because they pass through multiple hands through merger and acquisition activity. There's some famous ones that pass through about six different holders. The old Cuba Electric claim, which was the electricity system, the public electricity utility of Cuba, or certainly of Havana, called Cuba Electric, was a U.S.-owned business. and it passed through a timber company and a whole bunch of others. I think Macmillan Blodell. Anyway, it passed through and it's ended up at Office Max. Office Max, the office supply company, owns 77% of the old Cuba Electric claim. So I'm just giving this as an example of this kind of Byzantine world of these claims. In any case, they need to be settled. Cuba, as any state, had a right to expropriate. All states have a right under international law to expropriate. The issue is compensation. Governments in the United States, at state and federal level, certainly in Canada, they expropriate if they wish to. If they want to put a highway through a farmer's field, they expropriate the land, but they have to pay compensation. Cuba has recognized it must pay compensation. It does not agree with the valuations. So, needless to say. So there will be a negotiation. They're in past precedent, and I don't know how they're going to settle them at the end of the day. There's going to have to be some very creative work around this claim business. But there is precedent for settling these claims, quite explicit legal precedent. There's been about 44 precedent cases in very similar circumstances where the government of the United States has settled these claims. And this is done internationally all the time. And usually they're done in a lump sum government-to-government settlement as part of a negotiation between two governments who wish to accomplish some goal, like the establishment of diplomatic relations. Normally the claim holders get pennies on the dollar. The U.S. government will, if this is the model, will invoke its constitutional right over foreign policy for the interest of the state to reestablish diplomatic relations with another state and will move to settle the claims, and the claim holders will get what they get. Spain did this, Canada did this, everybody's done this with Cuba. The United States did it on 44 separate past occasions, this model. This is a very possible model for Cuba, that at some point they'll do a lump sum settlement. The Cuban claims are a bit different because they're more politicized than other claims. That's possible. The Cubans have a counterclaim, which complicates the mix. The Cubans, so that people know, and in North America we don't tend to know that this exists because it doesn't really get reported much. The Cubans have a claim against the United States of America for a lot of money, billions of dollars, for alleged damage and harm of the U.S. in trade and investment embargo against the economy of Cuba and against individual Cuban citizens who are all the enumerated individuals in this claim. I forget what the amount is. I believe it's several hundred billion dollars. The Cubans estimate that the net damage to the Cuban economy of the embargo over its entire lifetime is now set at $1.1 trillion. The Cuban view is it's an active economic warfare for which there now must be reparations. Now, that complicates things. At some point, both parties are going to have to deal with how do you deal with these claims in some way, shape, or form. That's the claims issue. This could be a long negotiation, yeah. That one. Yeah.
Okay. Let's shift a little bit to the business side of this, and there are actually several people asking questions about this, and I think this is an interesting issue. You know, there are political negotiations, and as the levers of the economic embargo begin to be lifted, several questioners are asking, to what degree is it possible that American corporations will put pressure on those negotiations and on Cuba, basically to give away the store, is one of the questions. And another questioner asks, just how big is the trade and investment opportunity for U.S. companies, given that Cuba has relatively normal relations with many other countries?
Right.
Is there really that great of an opportunity? And I know you can probably tell us about this until tomorrow morning.
They're very good questions, of course. I believe that there will be obviously a space for U.S. business in Cuba. Certainly, the Cuban view as well. By the way, when I speak, where I may sound like I'm speaking with a Cuban voice, needless to say, I don't speak for the government of Cuba. They can speak for themselves very well. But I've just spent so much time with them that I know how they think about certain things. So in a way, I'm a humble interpreter to you, not having a Cuban government minister here explaining this, just to share with you in a way on many of these issues how they see the world. They believe there's an important role for U.S. business in some future way, if provided they can get through all of these thorny issues. Cuba is not an empty vessel, needless to say. It's quite a bustling place with a lot of people already there. I think U.S. business will need to enter Cuba to compete with others for business. Other businesses from other countries that are already there will hypothetically at some point in the future have to compete head to head with U.S. business. Kinds of business that can be done are very fairly specific. I think there is a lot of opportunity. I think there are historic advantages to U.S. business. There's tremendous brand recognition still to this day for large retail brand products. There are cost benefits, transportation benefits. There's a certain sense of a historic trade. The shipping costs are lower if you're shipping from South Florida, for example. There's a lot of economic benefit to the U.S. trading relationship. There are certain sectors that I think are probably more prone and more open than others. If I had one message for U.S. business, though, I think it's for all businesses, all foreigners, not just U.S., this is one fundamental error I think that so many foreigners make when they enter the Cuban marketplace or deal with the Cubans on any issue, really. They don't listen. They don't listen to them. People go because they see it's a poor developing country and they see so much opportunity and they see, oh my God, if they just had containers filled with paint, we could paint the city of Havana and make it look all snazzy and put more neon lights in and all of this kind of stuff. The Cubans have a very specific set of their own priorities for what their economic development is, and painting the city of Havana may not be one of them. They have many other priorities to do. So often foreigners come, and if I had a message to U.S. business, I think the key is not to go to Havana to pitch your business because you think it's a great thing, and you see all the win-win and it's going to be great, and so Cuba so clearly needs this business in X, Y, or Z. You have to really sit with the Cubans to understand what they need and really listen to them, because they're tough negotiators in defending their interests and getting the most out of any deal, but they tend to be very consistent and clear and explicit in what their priorities are. And they will tell you, we would like to do business in the following areas because we need this, 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 and this. For those American businesses who offer those things, full opportunity once they can do it, of course, legally. And in terms of the question about U.S. business returning to essentially buy the country, the Cubans are highly attuned to history. The relationship with Cuba and the United States is an asymmetrical power relationship. Obviously, probably the unipolar superpower left in the world, certainly. Maybe the Chinese wouldn't agree anymore, but certainly that's true with a little kind of Caribbean island. It's an asymmetrical power relationship. So that often I think people outside Cuba have a very, what I would call an ahistorical appreciation of Cuba, in the sense that they think it all kind of began in 1959 and sort of, Fidel Castro and the revolution, and everybody got beamed down from outer space in 1959. But needless to say, there's a whole antecedent history of Cuba that goes before it. And to truly understand the psychology of the Cubans and how their worldview is codified, you have to profoundly understand their history and where they came from. And a lot of the explanations and the understanding of even the way they behave now had their roots and antecedents deep into Cuban history. A lot of the pieces of kind of revolutionary fabric of Cuba actually aren't related to communism or anything. They actually come from historic antecedents dating from the 1930s and 40s, when there was very kind of revolutionary progressive economic nationalist policies of various governments. So it's a quite nuanced place. And I only mention this because embedded in the historic kind of nationalist DNA of Cubans is a memory that by the 1950s, US business owned about two-thirds of the country and about 80% of the sugar lands, for example. And one of the lessons of history, if they're ever learned, that's kind of embedded in the hardwired into Cubans, is diversify your reliance on foreign partners and never let it happen again. Hmm. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, whatever cliche you want to run out. Is there a place for US business? Absolutely. Will any successive Cuban government allow it to happen again, given that Cuba in 2015 is not Cuba of 1959? It's in a way a more independent country. It's a more mature country in that sense, in the sense of its sovereign independence. I've seen them turn down large amounts of money for some of these considerations. There's a strong economic nationalist component to this. So even if the Castros were to leave tomorrow morning, if there were multi-party democratic elections in Cuba tomorrow morning, I think Cuba's evolved over the last six decades to a point where any successor Cuban government, and I don't think even the Cuban people anymore, who are now quite aware of the value of their national assets, would allow a situation such as it existed in the past. So to buy the country again, I don't think it would ever be permitted.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, so I want to come back to one of the other questions that has been raised about the opening of relations, and that is that the president has basically stated that this is a new strategy of engagement instead of isolation, and he's arguing that he hopes, at least, that it will have a positive effect on human rights and potentially democracy developing in Cuba. Do you think that's likely? Is it possible, for example, that the terms of the Helms-Burton Act, namely full democratic elections, will happen in Cuba? Is that likely in your view? And is that a positive thing?
On the road to a more normalized relationship, and if the trade and investment embargo is to be dismantled, and there now are increasing numbers of American voices that wish this to happen, including business voices, that political language embedded at the front end in the preambular language of Helms-Burton is a big problem. You're not going to get multi-party democratic elections in Cuba in the foreseeable future, unless the Cuban people desire it to happen. And then, in whatever, if they wish to rise up, for example, and have some kind of social rebellion or something like that, has not happened in six decades. I think the Cuban people in general are fatigued of the lack of economic opportunity. And that's one of the reasons why they were so excited about what happened on December the 17th. I think it's important not to misunderstand the premise of their excitement. The premise was not, and I'll speak very bluntly, the notion of some triumphal return of the United States to Cuba. They were excited because it meant to them some hope that evolution was possible in Cuba, domestically, their own country, inside their own country, and greater economic opportunity would be possible. And I think that if the intention of the policy opening on the part of the government of your own country is to collaborate with the Cuban people on achieving greater prosperity and economic opportunity and establishing a relationship with them, that is a very realistic thing. If the precondition is set, the trigger is set to the whole number of decisions that you have to have a democratic, multi-party democratic electoral system, then this is very plausible the whole thing could come screeching to a halt. one of the challenges, and I speak about this openly, embedded in a lot of the talk about the opening is a notion that it may be just a more sophisticated attempt at regime change. The old embargo didn't work. We'll try something more clever this time. And the danger in that, in the sense of if you do want a more normal relationship, and for people who don't, then there is no danger, but if for people who do, the risk in that narrative, if that narrative of regime change becomes the predominant narrative, where, for example, U.S. business is characterized as it has in the political rhetoric that comes out of Washington, D.C., it does get characterized this way for domestic consumption, that U.S. business are foot soldiers of political change in Cuba. The government of Cuba is going to say, I don't think so. If you want to come, U.S. business people, as grubby capitalists to make money with us, absolutely. Come in, because that's what we would like. If you're coming as the front end of a more clever way of imposing a political change from the outside, the whole thing will shut down. And when you listen to them, they're very they're quite clear about this. You know, when they talk. So I think they're both sides have to find a way to calibrate their expectations, to make sure the premises for what they're doing are aligned here, and let the relationship work itself through. This preconditionality at the front end of Helms-Burton is something that I'm not totally sure how the president will get around that one. I'm not sure about that.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. And I have to apologize that we are actually out of time. And so I think that'll have to be the last question. And this does conclude our program for this evening. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council, please join me in thanking Ambassador Mark Entwistle.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.